Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Patricia Kohlberg, your host for today's show. For today, we have a grab bag of good stuff for you. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker in their Left and the Law segment will review what's going on in the legal arena with abortion rights and the Supreme Court. Our book mole, Larry Bolden, will talk about The Hidden Child, an historical novel about eugenics, and Luisa Martinez reports back from her recent visit to Venezuela to observe the national elections there. We'll begin with Johanna Brenner speaking to Portland Association of Teachers President Elizabeth Teal. But before we go there, it's the season of giving, and I hope that all of our listeners out there will consider a donation to KBOO. Now is a great time to give because until New Year's Eve, your donation will be doubled by a generous matching grant from the Ronnie LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. To donate, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or just mail us a check to 28 Southeast 8th in Portland 97214. Help keep community radio alive in Portland. Today, Johanna Brenner sits down with Elizabeth Teal, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, about the union's proposal to solve a staffing crisis in the schools, maintain in-person instruction, and help address unprecedented social and emotional needs among students stemming from the COVID pandemic. Their proposal has met a chilly reception at PPS headquarters.
Elizabeth Teal, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks, Bay. Johanna. Thanks to be here.
Elizabeth is the president of the Portland Association of Teachers, who are proposing some changes to the school day in order to achieve what they call the time to get it right. Let's talk about what that means, Elizabeth, the time to get it right.
This school year has been incredibly difficult. One thing that is really important for people to know is that we are facing an extreme staffing shortage in our schools. That's true across the country, and it's true here in Portland, and it's impacting not just teachers, it's all of the people who work in schools. Portland currently has, last time I checked, over 180 unfilled positions. And so what that means is when we are trying to give students everything that we would give them if we were fully staffed, people are stretched beyond their capacity. We're short substitutes, so every day teachers in schools and our counselors and our principals and our vice principals, instead of doing their normal duties, they are being asked to substitute in classrooms where there's no substitute available. And in some of our schools in the last week, there have been as many as 15 unfilled positions. So that means 15 classrooms where there is not a teacher and people are scrambling to fill in and be with those students throughout the day. And we know that that is not the model of the education that our students deserve. So given the staffing shortage that we are facing and the incredible burden it places on the adults who are in the building trying to support students and trying to do multiple jobs at the same time, and knowing that that model never gives students what they need, we are asking to make some adjustments so that we can do things right for our kids.
So let's talk about some of those proposals. What are some of the main ideas you have about how to shift teachers around and provide more,
right,
planning time?
Yeah, a lot of these conversations started this fall when we heard from an alarming number of teachers asking for help resigning or taking a leave of absence because they felt like they were not able to do the job they were trying to do for kids. Teachers and educators have felt like they're being asked to choose between doing their job and taking care of their own health and their own families. 25% of educators reported that they were so overworked and overstressed that it was impacting their own health. And I've heard from educators who are worried that they are at risk of heart attack, that they're developing ulcers, that they are crying in their car after school every day. And so hearing what people are experiencing experiencing emotionally, you know, we surveyed members to find out what would help. How do we make this year manageable? One thing we know is that every time you lose an educator because they resign or go on a leave, there are more students who don't benefit anymore from that regular experienced educator who had been there with them and who had a relationship with them. So we primarily want to stabilize staffing so that people stop leaving the profession and leaving our schools to take care of their own health. And so when we asked educators what they need, the overwhelming response is that educators need more time. They need more time in every school week to be able to meet the needs of their students, and they need time throughout the year to be able to adjust and collaborate with colleagues and make school-wide plans to keep our buildings safe and the kinds of environments where students can do their best learning. And so then the big question is, how do you create more time, right? And for decades, you know, we've been fighting for more staffing, right? We have been fighting for smaller class sizes, more counselors and social workers, a better funded special education program. And, you know, a lot of listeners will remember fighting for the Student Success Act, which made a major infusion of funding into our school system. And that's still what we need. But this year with the staffing shortage, there are no more people to hire. So that would be our first choice of how to address the problem. Given the staffing shortage, trying to figure out how to make more time is harder. So the proposals we've made were our best ideas to how to create a stable school year where educators get what they need so they can continue serving students. So some of those ideas are adding a day in January for educators to work on school climate. Those are like those building-wide plans of how do we support students with behavioral needs? What do we do when someone's late to class? How does every teacher respond in a similar way to similar behavior? And we're asking for a couple hours every week at all levels for educators to be able to adjust instruction and work with each other and communicate with families. And we're asking for a few days spread out throughout the year for educators to work together on adjusting curriculum to meet the unique needs of students this year and assess work and make adjustments to move forward meeting the needs of the actual students we're serving.
Mm-hmm. So as I understand it, you obviously have to build some additional time for teachers to do these things into the school week. And so the question then comes, how do you do that and still continue to educate the students? So what are some of your ideas about that?
So at the elementary and middle school levels, we looked around to see how other districts create this kind of time. And one common way is to have an early release once a week. So it'd be a day when the school day for students ends a couple hours early, and educators can use that time to better meet students' needs every hour of the week. Mm-hmm. That's common practice in Oregon, and it used to be something that was common in Portland Public Schools. This year and for the last couple, we haven't had that time, but we need it badly, especially since educators are substituting during their planning time. And we've talked about ways that our community partners, our school buildings could support students during that two-hour release as is common practice across the state. So our proposal for an early release allows educators to have that time to better meet students' needs every minute of the week that students are there. And what we have suggested to the district is that during that two-hour release, there's lots of opportunities for students to be at school in supervised activities, if those are sports activities or, you know, with community organizations. We may have to partner more with the community to figure out some of those solutions that work best at every school site. But what we know is if teachers don't have the time to be able to respond to students' needs and communicate with families, then we're not doing it right every day. That is our hope and vision for what we believe, you know, the district can explore. And I guess this is another thing I want to point out. Right now, there is funding to be able to support schools this year. COVID relief funding is available. And ideally, like I said, that funding would be going to adding more staff to our schools to support our kids. We haven't been able to hire that staff. And so we have to find other solutions.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. We're speaking with Elizabeth Teal, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, who are trying to deal with a real crisis caused by the pandemic in our schools in terms of staffing and really delivering education to their students and caring for their students. So, mm-hmm. Elizabeth, you talked about one idea, which is early release one day a week. What are some of your other ideas?
Well, at the high school level, every day of the week has a different schedule. There are A days and B days, during which students have four different classes. There are A and B flex days, in which students have four different classes each day, but they're a little shorter, and then they have this flex time, which I'll talk more about in a minute. And then there are eight period days where kids have all eight classes and they're really short. We have heard all year from students and teachers that those eight period days aren't helpful, they're stressful, they have really low attendance, and that time could be better used. So looking at that and how to better meet the needs of our students who, you know, our high school students have reported feeling overwhelmed and stressed out and overstretched with eight classes. Last year, our high school students had four at a time, and then they switched that semester. And that they really mm-hmm. need help, individual help from their teachers. So we proposed rethinking that model, and instead of having that eight-period day that we have heard so often has not been helpful, restructuring that into a day when students who need help can get individual help from their teachers. And so we're calling it a flex day or a tutorial day. So instead of that time on Wednesdays and Thursdays that the district already has scheduled, those could be normal school days, and then one day a week we could have a day where students could access all of their teachers if they needed it and get that individual or small group support. We know that some of our students are doing okay academically, and some of our students really, really need support catching up.
So it seems quite reasonable for someone like me. You know, I don't know all the ins and outs and the nitty-gritty, but certainly the idea of experimenting with another way of delivering education and organizing the school day seems pretty reasonable. But as I understand it, the Portland Public Schools administration is resisting your proposals. And recently, an Oregonian editorial criticized your plan. They claimed that the PAT proposal abandons high school students because for one day each week, it swaps in-person instruction for what they call, quote-unquote, largely do-it-yourself learning. And they also, with regard to the younger students, the K through 8, they criticize the proposal to provide more planning time by releasing kids 2 hours early one day a week. They say this not only interferes with their education, but is really hard on working mothers who have largely shouldered homeschooling and childcare duties in the pandemic. So I think it would be great if you could respond to these criticisms.
Yeah, thank you. And first of all, I want to say educators are working mothers. We are a predominantly female workforce, and about half of my members of PAT are parents, many of them in Portland Public Schools. And so as a union that really represents working mothers, this question of how do we support families is at the center of what we think about and how we're approaching these problems. What we know is happening right now is that every day across the district, and especially at some of our schools, students are not getting what they deserve. We have schools where people report unsafe conditions every day, fights in hallways. Like I said, substitute teachers, a different substitute every day, or in some cases, a different substitute every hour because different people are coming in during their planning time. That is not a system that we should or can continue with to serve our kids. So we're looking at how do we readjust, acknowledging the reality of the staffing crisis that we're facing and the reality that many educators who are working mothers are right now considering whether they can continue in this profession if it feels like it's at the expense of their own health and their own ability to take care of their own families. So absolutely our goal is to serve our students sustainably and predictably throughout this school year and to avoid the kinds of disruptive, unplanned shutdowns that we're seeing increasingly across the country because of staffing shortages and safety issues.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. We're speaking with Elizabeth Teal, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, about how they are trying to address some really important and difficult issues of staffing and educating that have been produced and made actually much worse than they already were by the pandemic. Elizabeth, what I hear you saying is that your proposal has been mischaracterized because what you're trying to do is it's kind of less is more. It's kind of like if we shift around the way we deliver education, it looks as if, for example, instead of having students do one day where they do 8 classes, we're creating that more as a flex day so that students have the opportunity for more individualized instruction and teachers have opportunity for planning. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's two things I want to point out or underline about what you said. We do believe that quality is more important than quantity. We don't believe that the best thing for kids is to figure out ways to shorten the school week. What we do know is that we have students who are in school, but those minutes are not the quality of minutes that they deserve. When there are fights in classrooms, when there are different substitutes every day or every hour, students aren't getting what they deserve. So figuring out how do we maximize the quality of the time that educators are able to spend with students is our goal. And the other thing I think needs to keep coming front and center is that we are trying to preserve a school year. We have to look at the reality that our schools cannot continue to run if educators continue to resign or take leave. Our schools are dangerously close to not being able to run in person at all. When we are short 15 staff members in a building, that is not a model that any parent would want for their student. So if we can make some adjustments that stabilize the workforce and allow us to start growing and adding people instead of losing people, you know, like that's the direction we need to be moving in.
Mm-hmm. Sounds to me like what you're saying is we're in crisis management mode. And what we're proposing is a way to meet an immediate crisis so things don't get even worse than they already are. And I think what I hear from the school administration is that they basically want to just continue with the same old, assuming that the teachers will somehow be able to turn themselves inside out in order to pretend that nothing has really changed.
That's right. We are in a crisis, and leadership is when you look, you know, transparently and honestly about the conditions you're facing and find the best path. And that's what we're trying to do. We know that what we are doing right now is not sustainable. And if we do not make a different plan, we really risk extremely disruptive shutdowns for our students, and especially our students who have already been most impacted by the pandemic. And so I want to highlight our special education students. Some of our greatest shortages are in special education, students who need the most support. And we have had staffing shortages in special education for years. This is not a new problem. And like so many things in the pandemic, the problem is amplified right now to a breaking point. So we have to listen to educators about what they need so that we can keep those educators so that then we can start building the workforce we need to serve our kids.
That's interesting because one of the things that I read in the newspaper, a criticism that came from Portland Public Schools Administrator Sean Bird, was that he was kind of implying that no matter what kind of person you have in the class, in-person instruction is kind of the be-all and end-all. And I think you're trying to say that there's another way to approach this. And one of the things that a criticism he lodged that I think is important for you to address is that having one day where you have asynchronous time, that is to say where you have flex time, where students can meet with a counselor or meet with a teacher or study on their own or whatever, that this he said, would create even further inequities because it would deprive the most needy students of direct contact with teachers. But it sounds to me like you have a different point of view on that.
Well, what we're proposing is actually the opposite of that.
Right.
Our plan is that the most needy students would get direct in-person contact with their teachers on that flex day and get the support that they need. We know when students are struggling, having 35 or 40-minute class with 30 other kids on a Friday is not meeting their needs. The evidence, the data that the district has presented shows how clearly we can see that some of our students' needs are not being met. So instead of continuing to do the same thing that we can see is not working, we're trying to readjust so that we can give that time and support to students who are struggling, so that we can figure out new ways to meet the social-emotional needs and the academic needs of our students, and give educators time to be able to provide that for them every day of the week.
Great. So thank you so much for addressing those issues, Elizabeth. I wonder if you could talk just at the end here, how can people in the community support the teachers and convince the school district administration to look more favorably on your proposals?
We have a website. It's pdxteachers.org, and you can click on Time to Get It Right to read more about what we are asking for. I just want to say the support of parents and community members means everything to teachers. We are all in this to best support our kids, and I know that when families understand what our schools are facing, they will be able to work with us to figure out the best solutions we can. But what we can't ignore is the staffing crisis that we're in, because if we ignore that problem, the problem keeps getting worse, and that does not serve kids. So we are really grateful for the support we have received from families and community members, and we can use a lot more.
The name of the website, again, is?
It's on our PAT website. It's pdxteachers.org. And click on Time to Get It Right.
Great. We've been talking to Elizabeth Teal, the president of the Portland Association for Teachers. For listeners who want to support the teachers, information about the website and their proposal for Time to Get It Right and how to contact both the PPS administration and the school board will be posted later today on the Old Mole Variety Hour page on the KBOO website. Elizabeth, thanks again for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Johanna Brenner speaking with Elizabeth Teal about Portland Public Schools in crisis. Do you want to know why community radio is so important? It's here that you'll get an alternative perspective on issues that matter to you, like the proposal of the teachers' union to avert a crisis in our schools. KBOO needs your support to stay on the air. If you can, please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 and donate. You can also send a check to 28 Southeast 8th in Portland, 97214. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by year's end. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Luisa Martinez recently traveled to Venezuela as part of a small delegation of the Democratic Socialists of America to observe Venezuelan national elections on November 21st. This is her second dispatch from Venezuela, an assessment of the current political situation in that country, and a reflection on what that indicates about unfolding geopolitics in Latin America.
Hey, Old Moles. This is Luisa Martinez offering another report back from my recent trip to Venezuela. I was invited as part of a small delegation from the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, to be an election observer in Caracas, Venezuela. Over 300 observers were present from 55 countries around the world to witness Venezuelans exercise their right to vote. Dubbed the mega elections, Venezuelans cast their votes for 23 governors, 335 mayors, 253 lawmakers, and 2,471 counselors on November 21st. To begin, I'll give a quick primer on how elections technically work. Venezuelans vote through an integrated system of authorization. You need an ID card and a fingerprint. In fact, the voting machine is activated by your fingerprint, and you vote by selecting the logo of your party, though, of course, you can vote for multiple parties. It just takes a little bit longer. Your vote is then printed, and then you drop it off into your assigned box number, and you sign your ballot. So in Venezuela, you vote electronically, and that electronic vote is then confirmed with a paper receipt, which is then verified by your signature. August 26th is the last day to register with the National Registry to vote, which sounds like a long way away from the November 21st deadline, but you only register once, unlike in the United States, where we register every time that we move. If you want a more detailed explanation, you can go to the Venezuela Analysis article, which I can link on the Old Mole website. Now, unlike the cartoonish U.S. narrative regarding Venezuela as some sort of a cruel dictatorship where up is down, black is white, and upstanding middle-class Venezuelans are randomly beaten by Chavistas, what our delegation witnessed was an orderly, peaceful, and fairly quick process. One observation I'll mention is that there's no mail-in voting and no absentee voting. I attended a press conference by the CNE, which is the National Electoral Council, and they made it very clear that it just doesn't exist in Venezuela. In fact, as far as I can tell, mail-in voting doesn't exist in Latin America. And culturally, voting is a collective process that heavily involves the community. Arguably, this is distinct from the way that voting is considered in the United States, especially in Oregon and Washington, which has eliminated in-person voting. Now, admittedly, I'm not the best person to ask. I gracefully received my citizenship about 2 months before President Trump took office. But paperwork aside, I've been politically active for 12 years and did witness successful attempts at voter suppression bills passed in Florida, including what happened in 2011. Clearly aimed at the black vote, the 2011 voter suppression bill eliminated voting the Sunday before Election Day. Now, 50% of black people vote on this day because of a longstanding program called Souls to the Polls. Folks go to church, and then church officials organize vans to take people to their closest voting location. Again, it is a collective experience. But back to Venezuela. To give a political analysis of the situation, the GPP, the Grand Patriotic Poll, the socialist coalition currently elected to power, and the PSU, which is the coalition's biggest party, swept the elections, winning 19 out of the 23 states for governor, except for one state, Barinas, on the Colombian border, which will see another election January 9th after the opposition candidate was disqualified because of administrative and criminal inquiries against him. An important thing to note is that the opposition is back on the electoral route, respecting the Constitution and acknowledging that Nicolas Maduro is the president of Venezuela. The Venezuelan government left the dialogue table that was happening in Mexico between them and the opposition, and of course, the United States always being in the background, because of the Alex Saab extradition. Briefly, Alex Saab was a Venezuelan diplomat on his way to Iran to negotiate a much-needed gasoline supplies, food, medicine, and other critical materials overseas as a way of circumventing the lethal U.S. sanctions. Saab's plane was forced to land in Cabo Verde and was imprisoned there for a year and a half by the United States, despite there being no extradition treaty, and the Interpol order being released after his capture. It is obvious the imprisonment of Saab was made without any proper legal basis and is another form of judicial and physical intimidation by the U.S. government. He is now illegally extradited and imprisoned in Miami. The Venezuelan government may return to the table next year. It will be the constitutional right of the opposition to try to run a recall campaign against President Maduro, and whether or not they do so will very much be on the table. Another important thing to note is that the European Union participated and certified the elections, the first time in 8 years. This indicates a break away from the Washington narrative. This is perhaps the reason why the United States invited Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president of Venezuela, more often referred to as the president of Narnia, to the laughably titled Summit of Democracies last week. Even corporate news outlet, the New York Times, questioned the event with the following news blurb. Biden rallies global democracies as U.S. hits a rough patch. The president kicked off his summit as critics questioned the guest list and whether the United States could be an effective advocate for democracy amid problems at home. This, coupled with the decline of the Lima Group, The increasing treatment of the U.S.-controlled organization, American States, as a fringe association by Latin American governments is prompting many to wonder whether or not we'll be seeing the return of the pink tide. Leftist populist Pedro Castillo won Peru recently, and Chile has a tense election in December where they'll have two choices. José Antonio Kast, an extreme right Pinochetista candidate whose father, it has recently come to light, was a bona fide member of the Nazi Party, or Gabriel Boric, a young 35-year-old progressive who rose to political prominence through the student protest movement. One thing that's obvious and distinct from the last time, and that is the renewed role of violence for left leadership. The right wing of Latin America, propped up by the firm hand of U.S. imperialism, makes it clear that it does not flinch at the prospect of violence, but in fact welcomes it. When I was in Venezuela in June, I heard President Evo Morales speak, which was essentially a retelling of the coup where he narrowly escaped with his life. Lula spent a year and a half in jail as a result of trumped up corruption charges and lawfare used against him, but he's now cleared for a presidential run in 2022. This can also be seen in the recent win of Xiomara Castro Zelaya, wife of Jaime Zelaya, in Honduras. Jaime Zelaya, for those who remember, was couped in 2009 after attempting to implement really moderate reforms, including things like land redistribution. Madam Zelaya recently indicated that she would abandon diplomatic relations with Taiwan in favor of China, and President Ortega in Nicaragua did the same. In fact, total China-Latin American trade increased from almost $18 billion in 2002 to almost $316 billion in pre-pandemic 2019, a fact that clearly weighs heavily on empire. Now, whether or not Cubans, Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, and Latin Americans will ever achieve sovereignty outside the control of the U.S. government is in the air. But what is clear on the horizon is the emergence of a multipolar world, something that gives hope to this Latin American.
That was a report from Venezuela by the Mole's Latin American correspondent, Luisa Martinez. The music was from Chavez No Se Va, or Chavez Don't Go, by Grupo Madera. Where else, except on KBOO, are you going to hear on-the-ground reporting about Latin America from a socialist point of view? We're very lucky here in Portland to have non-commercial, listener-supported, and volunteer-powered community radio. Right now is a grand time to become a member of the KBOO community because until December 31st, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar by a generous grant from the Ronnie LaCroix Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. You can contribute by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321 or sending your contribution by snail mail to 28 Southeast 8th, Portland, 97214. You can make a one-time donation, or better yet, become a monthly sustainer. Now we turn to book mole Larry Bolden, who takes a look at the new novel by Louise Fine called The Hidden Child, which explores the eugenics movement of the early 20th century through the heartbreaking story of an epileptic child and her family. As always, I will be reading Larry's review for him. If you are one of the many who believe that eugenics was a tool only of Nazi Germany, you should read the excellent and thoroughly researched historical novel by Louise Fine entitled The Hidden Child. Often, the best way of really bringing home the horrors of a practice is to embody it, to show how real people are affected by the practice. Louise Fine has done just that in her sad but wonderful novel. As Eleanor is watching over her beautiful 5-year-old child, Mabel, frolicking in a park, suddenly and out of nowhere, Mabel begins to act in a most frightening way. A postman has just dropped his bike in shock as he points to the beautiful child in front of him. Quote, Eleanor turns in confusion. Mabel! Sticks scattered around her, she's sitting on the dusty ground, face twisted, her eyes weirdly rolling back. Her chin drops to her chest once, twice, hands twitching. Eleanor's feet are rooted to the ground in horror. Her daughter looks as though she's been possessed. Her normal sweet expression vanished behind the contorted features of her face. End quote. But this is not the first nor the last of these fits. Eleanor's instinctive reaction is to brush off the momentary behavior, and she implores the postman not to fetch a doctor. Besides her inclination to deny and hope the momentary aberration is just that, passing and of no significance, she is married to a psychologist who is a leader of the eugenics movement in the UK, and who would be most embarrassed to admit his daughter is among the unfit who need to be weeded from society. Fine skillfully weaves her story. Edward, the psychologist's husband, insists that Mabel's ailment must not be discovered, both to protect the child from being singled out and ridiculed, and to protect his own reputation within the movement. He insists that it will be best for all concerned if Mabel is locked away in a sanitarium and kept from public scrutiny. Although heartbroken, Eleanor cannot stand up to her husband and his professional stature and eventually defers to his judgment. Unable even to visit her young child, she slowly becomes more and more aware that her husband sees only what he wants to see, and that he even skews his research to omit evidence that would count against his theories regarding the improvement of the race via incarceration, sterilization, and other drastic measures. The story itself is compelling and so well written, but the controversy behind the theory is really the most important part of this novel. Fine herself has a child with a seizure disorder, and that no doubt adds to her careful and thorough research in writing this book. In her notes at the end of the novel, she writes, I was therefore rather shocked that when I began to look into the ideas behind the inhumane treatment of people with disabilities, including epilepsy, in the 1920s, I found, in fact, that Nazi Germany took its lead in this area from widespread and accepted eugenics ideas circulating in both the United Kingdom and the United States. The eugenics movement had been born in England in the late 19th century and was extremely widespread in the first 30 years or so of the 20th century. The pseudoscience of eugenics and other theories, such as craniology, are thoroughly debunked by Stephen Jay Gould in his superb set of essays, The Mismeasure of Man. Like Edward in this novel, many of the experiments meant to support the theories were manipulated such that only confirmatory data was allowed and contra-evidence swept under the rug. End quote. This novel and the story stand on their own quite apart from the eugenics controversy, but the social and political importance of the book needs to be emphasized. I will end with another quote from the author's endnotes. Legislation was proposed for compulsory sterilization and incarceration of those considered weak-minded, a catch-all phrase for those with learning difficulties, as well as epileptics, criminals, those with behavioral difficulties, alcoholics, and anyone else considered undesirable and ruinous to the health of the population in general. I have been talking about Louise Fine's 2021 novel, The Hidden Child. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kullberg, reading this morning for Larry. Did you know that KBOO has trained thousands of people, like me, about how to make radio, and all for free because of support from listeners like you? Our goal is to raise $45,000 by year's end. You can donate to KBOO by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by snail mail to 28 Southeast 8th in Portland, 97214. The Supreme Court began hearing oral arguments this month on the constitutionality of Mississippi's ban on abortions past 15 weeks. In their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker consider the legal reasoning and precedents invoked in the upcoming Supreme Court decision and the likely impacts of overturning Roe v. Wade. They also discuss how this historical period differs from earlier eras of struggle around abortion rights.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments last week on the constitutionality of Mississippi's ban on abortions past 15 weeks in the Dobbs versus Jackson women's health case. 26 states are poised to ban abortion in some form if the Supreme Court upholds the ban or decides to overturn Roe v. Wade altogether. So, Mike, let's start with the Mississippi case and the legal arguments presented before the court and what you see as some of the critical issues here and the critical legal arguments.
Well, Jen, the Supreme Court did not really leave us in suspense. There's really no doubt that they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. The five Republican-appointed justices made it very clear that they want to abolish any constitutional right to abortion. It was established nearly 50 years ago. Kavanaugh framed it as an issue of neutrality, that the Constitution's neither pro nor anti-abortion, and that it should be left to states or individuals or Congresses or anybody other than the court.
Yeah, let's talk for a bit about the importance of a federal law as opposed to pre-Roe v. Wade. Abortion was legal in four or five states, starting with Colorado and then New York, Oregon closely after that, before Roe v. Wade decriminalized abortion. And in many states, you could go before a panel of doctors and make a case for therapeutic abortion. If you had a medical issue or rape or incest or said you were going to kill yourself or your children, so you had to have a sad story. So a profoundly important part of the abortion rights movement was that this was a decision women could make, that you didn't have to have a sad story and come before a panel of patriarchs to authorize your decision. And some of the worry now centers on how much rode on Roe v. Wade, how much was invested in it. But what do you see the legal arguments that were critical? I mean, obviously the Constitution doesn't talk about abortion, but there's a 14th Amendment, the 9th Amendment. There are a number of amendments that do grant personal liberty and restrictions from state action that interfere with privacy. That was one area of legal argument. And then the other was, does the state have an interest in protecting the fetus? When is, you know, the issue of viability that was first framed in terms of the trimesters, three trimesters, then in a later case with Planned Parenthood versus Casey, it was more around viability, fetal liability. Do you see any of the grounding of Roe v. Wade and this new decision around the Mississippi case as similar in terms of the constitutional grounding of the reasoning of the justices?
Well, we have a kind of negative image of the rights that you've referred to. The concept of viability is going to be abandoned by the majority. Even Justice Roberts, who's tried to do a compromise that would accept the 15 weeks but uphold the right to abortion before that, was ready to jettison the concept of viability, said 15
weeks.
Which
usually puts that at around at least 24 weeks. And of course, there's also the question of a living fetus, a child that also has a number of anomalies requiring care. So there's never been a clear boundary around what constitutes fetal viability.
Well, Roberts wants to cut the whole idea loose. He said 15 weeks is plenty of time for a woman to make a choice. That's the important issue. But he was getting no takers, because it's clear that five or maybe even six of the justices are going to completely reject the notion of bodily autonomy, the right of privacy, the right of a woman to control her own body. They're going to frame the issue as a matter of neutrality, that they're going to say the court is not going to pick a side on this socially contentious issue and let everybody else decide, everybody else being the states or the counties or Congress. They clearly believe that abortions are bad. And what's going to happen, I think it's clear, is that we're going to get a decision that's going to be five or six people supporting it. They're going to hold that advancements in the law of adoption and giving up children protect women's equal participation in the work life and economic life after childbirth, that these developments have eroded the value of Roe. It'll say that these decisions were terribly wrong because the Constitution is neutral on abortion and that the Supreme Court is being democratic and it's making a fair compromise because they're not requiring abortion bans, they're simply permitting them. And that's what's going to happen.
Now, it may be obvious, but can you remind us what's important about federal laws and versus the calls for states' rights? And of course, that was a very big part of the struggle of the civil rights movement and Brown versus the Board of Education, was states' rights to define and defend segregation versus federal laws that force states in compliance with national legal rights of people.
Well, a federal law, a constitutional right, is something that prevails regardless of a temporary majority. It's essential, for example, insular minorities like Black people, who are never going to be a majority, are protected by a federal constitution. Rights such as the right to bodily autonomy, the right of women to do what they will and to treat themselves how they want to treat themselves, are rights that were seen in Roe v. Wade as fundamental, that is, rights that cannot be overridden by a legislature or a democratically elected body.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a memory of a progressive era, a very short-lived progressive era of Supreme Court decisions during the social movements of particularly the 60s and 70s, but the lessons here related to turning to the Supreme Court also weigh heavily on us, even though you're saying on the one hand, it's very important what happens at the federal level. On the other hand, there are limits in what we can expect, particularly from the Supreme Court.
This is a reminder that for most of the Supreme Court's 200-year history, it has been profoundly conservative, and it cannot be relied on. So I'm going to ask you, Jan, I know you have thought a lot about this issue. You even made a movie about these brave doctors providing abortions in places like Oklahoma, where they don't have the consensus of support they do here in Portland. What do you think this is going to mean politically?
I mean, the film also follows some of the history of Roe v. Wade as a compromise decision. And even Justice Ruth Ginsburg, before joining the court, had criticized Roe v. Wade decision for ending a nascent movement to liberalize abortion law through legislation. And in the film, we drew out this line of argument that Roe v. Wade was as much about a doctor's freedom to practice his profession as he thinks best, you know, making the best medical decision. And the idea that this is a decision between a woman and her doctor, it wasn't centered as much on women's right to bodily autonomy, and the privacy aspect of it got framed often as privacy between a doctor and his patient. It didn't grant women access. I think on the positive side, the abortion rights movement has overall moved from pro-choice to taking up the critiques of the reproductive justice movement. Black feminists have had a profound effect on expanding our call for abortion rights to include the rights to sexual freedom, the rights to bear children and raise them in a healthy environment, to be supported and sustained in other aspects of health care and economic rights. Even Planned Parenthood, that's tended to be fairly conservative and defensive and narrow in its approach to abortion rights, has adopted the reproductive rights movement, reproductive justice campaign.
Well, that's essential, don't you think? I mean,
yeah.
The Hyde Amendment, for example, meant that abortion was optional. It meant that poor people could not get an abortion. So that completely removed abortion from the role of a medical procedure, like knee replacements that everybody was entitled to, and made it something more akin to a facelift, a luxury that rich women could support and have, but that poor people were not entitled to. That was actually embraced by people like Biden and Al Gore during the 70s, 80s,
and a lot of the Democratic establishment, and even mainstream pro-choice organizations didn't fight that very much. And even though, like in Oregon, dedicated funds in many states make up for the lack of federal Medicaid dollars that come in, there is also, I think, potential here for a widening and a more radical social movement around reproductive justice that goes beyond Roe v. Wade and pins less of our hopes to paving that road. I mean, it's important to acknowledge the loss and the profound attack it represents on feminism at base, as well as poor women and women of color who are less apt, as they've always been, to be able to travel someplace to get an abortion. Before Roe v. Wade, taking a flight to California was called the non-family plan, where you took a flight to California to get an abortion, and it was pretty common. And I think there's more recognition now of how the intersectionality of these issues, how the same movement that fights abortion also fights against regulation that would make our air clean, the rights of parental leave. But this point that adoption is a reasonable alternative to ending a pregnancy is so obscene in its implications. Forcing women to carry a child and forcing motherhood. And that was a big part of the argument early on of feminism, was rejecting mandatory motherhood, which is part of what it means to be forced to carry a pregnancy against your will.
You know, 75 times more dangerous in Mississippi to give birth than it is to have an abortion.
Yes.
The Supreme Court raced right past that fact and then kept trying to frame it as a women's health issue or a fetal health issue.
Yeah. I mean, one reason I focused on abortion providers and the history of struggle within the medical profession and among doctors and how they fight abortion stigma in their own profession, the role of women and feminists coming into the medical profession, is that the medical profession since the late 19th century was very involved in the criminalizing of abortion and has had an important role in the policing of this issue and did benefit from Roe v. Wade. But I think now there has been more support for abortion training, making it a mandatory part or expected part of OBGYN training. And so it'll be interesting how the healthcare field responds to these restrictions and how organizing around this develops over the next year.
Yeah, well, don't you think the role of medical providers is receding? I mean, now with abortion pills, isn't that a technological variation there? How
surgical abortions will need to be around, as Sarah Prager says in the film, as long as women are getting pregnant. I mean, there are some advantages of surgical abortion in terms of it's fast. If it's accessible, it can be done very quickly. Medical abortions can be drawn out more. They both should be available, but I don't think medical abortion is a substitute or reason to downplay the importance of surgical abortions, which means you go someplace, you have a procedure, and then you leave and it's done. So a lot of women can't take 3 days off of work to have someone with her where she expels the pregnancy. So I do think both are important, and that there are communities that develop around the feminist model of healthcare. You know, we filmed in a number of clinics around the country, and these are also places for training and where people talk about their bodies and their experiences together. So that has been also a part of the feminist legacy of healthcare that we need to defend. And it's very patient-centered, and a lot of those principles are, I think, evident in the film Our Bodies, Our Doctors. I hope people check it out. These people have a lot to say, to speak to the moment, the dreadful moment we're in. Well, we'll stop for today and continue to follow the road ahead for Roe. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Supreme Court and oral arguments earlier this month on the Mississippi ban on abortion and what we expect to happen politically.
That does it for our show today. Thanks to Moles, Johanna Brenner, Luisa Martinez, Larry Bolden, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker, and our guest Elizabeth Teal. Thanks also to Denise Morris for her editing assistance. Every Monday morning, the Old Moles bring you views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. You can show your support for the Old Mole Variety Hour and for KBOO by donating now. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by snail mail to 28 Southeast 8th in Portland 97214. Thanks to all of you who have already given to keep KBOO on the air. I'm going to leave you now with some music by native rock and blues artist Keith Sekola, entitled NDN Cars.
Your head ahead. Pound of the wheel drumming in my brain. My dash is dusty, my plates are expired. Please, Mr. Officer, let me explain. I got to make another powwow tonight. I'll be singing 49 down by the riverside, looking for sugar, riding in my Indian car.